Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work. Enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikaitis.
Hello, and thanks so much for joining us here for episode 324 with Adam Ghazali. I think you'll love this chat with Adam because he has done so much research into the brain and human capacity, where it's strong, where it's not so strong, our focusing possibilities, and how to make the very best of it. So you'll learn, one, the strengths and limitations of the human brain, two, three focus levers that you can learn to control, and three, mindfulness practices that train attention. So if you'd like to take a look at the show notes or the transcript or the links to Adam's we've referenced, it's over at awesomeatyourjob.com/ep324. And while at awesomeatyourjob.com, I encourage you to check out some of our cool stuff. One cool thing is the Gold Nugget email list. So if you find yourself running or driving or cooking, doing something with your hands busy while you're listening to the show, we take the notes for you and send them to your inbox so you can check out the summary insights from Adam and the 323 guests who've gone before him right there at awesomeatyourjob.com. Now, here's Adam's story. Adam Ghazali, MD, PhD, is professor in neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at UC San Francisco and the founder and executive director of Neuroscape, a translational neuroscience center engaged in technology creation and scientific research of novel brain assessment and optimization approaches. Dr. Ghazali is co-founder and chief science advisor of Achille Interactive Labs, a company developing therapeutic video games, and co-founder and chief scientist of Jazz Venture Partners, a venture capital firm investing in experiential technology to improve human performance. Additionally, he is a scientific advisor for over a dozen technology companies, including Apple, GE, Magic Leap, and The Void. He's filed multiple patents, authored over 125 scientific articles, and delivered over 540 invited presentations around the world. He wrote and hosted the nationally televised PBS special, The Distracted Mind, with Dr. Adam Ghazali, and co-authored the 2016 MIT Press book, The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. Winner of the 2017 Prose Award, Dr. Ghazali has received many awards and honors, including the 2015 Society for Neuroscience Science Educator Award. Here is Adam. Adam, thanks so much for joining us here on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I've been so excited to have this conversation ever since I heard you on Brett McKay's Art of Manliness podcast. And so first of all, I've got to know, you said in that show, stay tuned to 2018 because you were working on creating the first prescription video game or digital medicine. Where does that stand today?
Well, we have advanced. So we, at the very end of 2017, we being Achille Interactive, which is a company I spun out from my research at UCSF, and we announced that we had positive outcomes on our FDA phase 3 trial that was targeting improvement of attention abilities in children diagnosed with ADHD. And so that's the big piece that we're waiting for to then go ahead and submit to the FDA. That process has just happened, and so this is a medical device pathway, and it's the first of its kind for this type of treatment, and it would be the first non-drug treatment for that condition, for ADHD. So we don't know exactly how long the process takes, but we're in it now. So hopefully not so long.
That's cool. Congratulations. And since I just jumped in there, maybe you can back it up a second. And so what is the game and how does it make an impact on brains?
Yeah, so, you know, maybe I'll take even one more step back. The idea behind building a video game as a digital medicine really popped into my mind after years of research in neuroscience and as a clinician and neurologist back in 2008. So it's been 10 years ago that I started on this pathway that is just sort of reaching this really major milestone now of FDA approval. But, you know, the concept is that we can engage our brains at a very high level in a targeted experience. And this experience can be adaptive, what we call a closed loop, meaning it's challenging you and giving you rewards right at the edge of your ability. So it's pushing you, and it's doing this based on your real-time metrics, your performance, your physiology. And we can use this type of experience as a way of optimizing the brain networks that it activates. And That was the general idea that I had. We built a video game called NeuroRacer back in 2008. We started the process. I designed it, brought in friends from LucasArts to help us develop it. And then we did multiple years of research, really showing that we can improve older adults' ability, which is where a lot of my research background had been focused on, improving their ability to pay attention on very, very different tasks and to also hold information in memory. And that was published in Nature in 2013, and also with neural recording showing the mechanisms in the brain that led to that improvement in attention. And then that led to the birth of Achille, a patent behind the technology, and now multiple clinical trials, as well as the phase three trial for ADHD treatment that I just described to you. So that's the journey.
Oh, that is cool. And so I want to get into the journey and your book, The Distracted Mind, and practical things that professionals can do to be less distracted and have more great focus. So maybe could you start us off by sharing, you wear a number of hats all at once these days. Could you share a little bit of the story and thread that ties together your professorship, Neuroscape, Achille Interactive Labs, and Jazz Venture Partners, all you're up to?
Sure. So it does seem, and it could give the impression that I'm spread thin, given that I've co-founded several companies, a venture fund. I'm the director of a research center and a professor at UCSF. I've written books and I give a lot of talks, but the reality is I feel like I do absolutely one thing. They're all related to each other. They're all built on the premise that technology can be developed in a thoughtful way with the goal of improving how our brains function. And that could be for people that are healthy and just want to improve their concentration and their memory. It could be part of what we would think of as education, young developing minds on a more positive pathway than we currently see happening. And then, of course, as a type of medicine, which we've already been discussing, when people have deficits. So the companies that Jazz invests in, where I'm a partner, the companies I formed, like Achille, another company, SynSync, a newer one, what we do at our research center at Neuroscape, all of it is built to accomplish that goal of having our technology, our non-invasive, consumer-friendly, both, you know, from affordability and accessibility point of view, do more than entertain us and allow us to communicate, but actually enhance what makes us human and really improve our brain function.
That's cool. So much to dig into there. And so when it comes to brain function, it seems that your brain is functioning pretty prolifically in terms of, geez, hundreds of presentations, 100 scientific articles, and multiple roles all at once. Do you have a personal secret for how you're pulling this off, or, you know, what's sort of the key behind this?
You know, one of the keys is what I said. You know, I really do feel like I have only one thing that I do. I don't have lots of different voices. It doesn't matter what podcast I am on or what audience I'm speaking in front of. I have one message. I have one way of presenting it. I have one goal. I always say to my, especially my lab here, when we hire new people and take on new projects, that I have one tree, and I'm willing to have more branches, but I'm not willing to have a second tree. And so a lot of it is just figuring out, like, where is that tree? What is part of, you know, the core of my mission and where I want to direct my attention? So, you know, I think that's one thing that allows me to seem very productive. I am accomplishing a lot of things, but it's all in the same framework. When I watch someone else, you know, do things that seem really disparate than each other, it just boggles my mind how they hold that all together. And, so that's one of the things. And then I'm really passionate about it. I found something that I absolutely love. I wake up thinking about it. You know, it's what I'll talk about in a bar with friends. It's my life. And I'm always encouraging young people that I might mentor and advise that's the secret. That's what they have to find. If they're not doing it now, they have to look elsewhere, because it'll always come back and haunt them if they passed up or missed that opportunity to find, you know, their true passion in life.
Okay. Well, so let's dig into some of the takeaways here. You sort of unpack a number of these discoveries and practical applications for a popular audience in your book, The Distracted Mind. So what's sort of the big idea behind the book?
So the book, The Distracted Mind, is sort of a little bit of a mashup between myself as an author and Larry Rosen as an author. So I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. I work in a laboratory where we do functional brain imaging and look at how neural networks underlie different performance metrics like attention and memory abilities and how interference degrades those abilities. So I study really the neural mechanisms of interference through distraction and multitasking. Well, Larry is really like a field psychologist. He's out there looking at what real world things like Facebook and having mobile phones on your bodies might impact your relationships and your school performance and things of that nature. And so that's the overview that we try to show. It's like a deep dive into what's going on in the brain, why we don't have the ability to do all the things we want to do all at the same time. It takes a very evolutionary perspective on that. I sort of dug deep into optimal foraging theories and other views that I think connect our evolutionary path of what has grown in our brains that are strong and what are its limitations and how technology impacts us. Largely in a negative way, although the very end of the book is the prescriptive part. How can we change our behaviors to interact with technology in a healthier way? Neither Larry or I feel that the path is to just abandon it. I always say we're not putting that tech genie back in the bottle. It is here. How do we live with it in a better way? And then, of course, what I already have told you about is how do we flip this story around completely. How do we think about technology as a tool to actually help how our brains function and the future of where we can go with that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so then let's talk a bit about the brain fundamentally. Where is our human brain strong versus limited? And what do we do with that information?
Well, I'd say one of the main strengths in many ways defines us as human, and it might be the pinnacle, the most unique thing that our brains are capable of compared to other animals, is the setting of very high level goals, goals that are very time delayed. You could set a goal a decade in the future, and you could have goals, even immediate goals, that are interwoven with other goals and other people's goals. And that type of ability, I think is what is fundamental for all of the achievements that we have as a species, our communities and our societies and our languages, our art, our music, our technology really depends upon that. And these goals, they also challenge us because they lead us to believe we're almost capable of anything and we are not. And we have the flip side of it is that we have these very fundamental limitations in how our brain works. When it comes especially to the abilities that enable us to enact our goals. So our attention, our ability to focus it and sustain it, our working memory, holding information in mind for just very rapid periods of time, and then how we deal with having multiple goals that converge in terms of enacting them, how we either switch between them or multitask them. And when it comes to these abilities, what we call cognitive control, which sort of wraps it, an umbrella term around all of those concepts I just mentioned, they're limited. In many ways, when you push other animals to behave in the way that we do, to multitask and to engage in such a way, you see that we have actually really similar limitations. We can focus our attention, but we can't, and even there, the filter's not perfect, but we also can't distribute our attention broadly. We can only take in a very limited amount of the information around us. When we try to hold information in mind, what we call working memory, there's a degradation in the fidelity of that information that, occurs very rapidly. And when we attempt to multitask or switch between tasks, we see that there is a cost for that type of goal setting and enactment. We do not engage in two goals that both demand our attention as well as if we have only one. And that's because the networks in the brain that are responsible for each goal, they can't parallel process. They have to switch between each of the tasks you're trying to engage in. And with each switch, there's a loss of some of that information resolution. And so that's the sort of premise of the book, that there's a disconnect between what we want to do, our goal setting, and what we're capable of doing, our goal enactment. And that's what leads to interference and leads to what we refer to again and again as the distracted mind.
Yeah, that really sums up kind of the whole, in many ways, human condition in terms of, I remember when I first learned economics in high school and they talked about, you know, how they call it the dismal science because, you know, we have unlimited desires, but finite resources. And I was like, yes, this is already my whole life. I'm very intrigued to learn more about this field. And so it connected and resonated. And that applies not only to, you know, the use of time and money, but in fact, just what we can put our brain toward.
Exactly. You know, when it came down to writing this book, it was actually a challenge for me because I had sort of moved on from the distracted mind story to my new research focus, which is how do we use our understanding of the distracted mind to build tools to help our brains, make them less distracted. And so it's sort of like almost like a step back, you know, into my history of my research. But when certain ideas, I was able to formulate, like the one I just described to you, other ideas around foraging for information and how it compares to how other animals forage for food, then it felt fresh to me. And I was excited about writing that in the book. And, you know, I think, you know, for the most part, it's all pretty logical. And most people in many ways could sort of just introspectively appreciate these things in their own behavior. But it is, I think it's helpful and has value to break it down, especially from the neuroscience perspective.
Well, I'd love to then dig into some of this in terms of how can we have more cognitive control to achieve what we want, sort of, you know, day in and day out. And so where do you think is the best place to start in terms of setting some foundation? Should we talk about foraging theory or should we start elsewhere?
Yeah. I mean, I could give you a little bit about foraging theory. It can get pretty heady and long, so we could do it briefly. But the reason I bring foraging theories, optimal foraging theories, into the book in the first place and into these discussions is because I don't fancy myself as a self-help guru that I could just like throw out things that I tried in my life and encourage other people to do them. So the idea was that if I was going to present prescriptive advice about how people should engage in healthier behaviors with technology, I wanted to do so from a conceptual framework and use that to guide the advice. And so the framework is really based on how we as humans forage for information in a similar way to how other animals forage for food. That the primate brain has co-opted a lot of these ancient reward systems, but instead of being for survival, they are for information. And there's a lot of data to support that. And if that's true, if that premise is true, then could we use the models that describe why other animals, forage in the particular way that they do? Could we use that to describe why we engage with technology in a very particular way? And then use that as a basis to say, oh, these are the areas that we could change our behavior. And so the model that I use is known as the marginal value theorem. It describes how animals forage in patchy environments, like a squirrel in a tree eating acorns or nuts. The resources they have are in a limited space, and there's these empty areas in between those resources. And so when a squirrel is in a tree, they're making an unconscious decision about the benefits of remaining in that tree, even though the nuts are getting less and less as they eat them. And they're comparing that with how close the nearest tree is full of nuts. And at some point, they make the decision to switch and jump from one tree to the other. I'm creating a comparison that we're sort of like those squirrels. Our patches are information patches like your mobile phone or a web browser or Facebook. And you could stay in there or you could leave to the next one. And the influences that drive us to stay and leave are related to how we're consuming those resources in the patch we're now. And what one of the premises I make is that we've shown, and there's data that suggests, that we are now accumulating boredom and anxiety, both anxiety of fear of missing out on something else and also performance anxiety, very rapidly. And so we have this very rapid diminishing return of remaining in a patch, an information patch. There's also this other force that other patches, those other trees, which are our links on a website or another browser tab, or just having your phone in your pocket, the other information sources are so accessible. So it's so easy to abandon the one you're in and just move over to the next one. And that those forces of boredom and anxiety, making our enjoyment and our satisfaction of being in an information source last longer, as well as the accessibility to the next one, drives this tendency that we all have to just rapidly switch between them and not really engage in a sustained, continuous way in one information source.
Intriguing. So then, well, first I want to talk about the squirrels if I can.
Sure.
Now, when we study squirrels that are engaging this activity, do they in fact behave in a mathematically optimal sort of a way? It's like, yep, that is indeed the perfect decision to jump to that next tree, squirrel. Well done.
Yeah. So the marginal value theorem, which is used by not neuroscientists, but more ecological behavioral scientists, have shown that they are able to mathematically predict the behavior of many animals, both in laboratory settings as well as in the wild. So that field is really interesting. And, you know, there's other types of behaviors like predator-prey relationship, there's other optimal foraging theories. But this particular one, the marginal value theorem, is about animals foraging in patchy environments. And it has been shown it's not perfect. There are factors that influence it that are not always predictable. But it is a pretty interesting field of research. And we don't have the mathematical relationships of how the marginal value theorem applies to how humans forage for information. It's, you know, essentially a hypothesis in the book that I thought maybe would set off, you know, research in that particular direction. But I think, you know, it does go a long way, at least intuitively, of explaining why we are so susceptible to this rapid switching behavior that we engage in, especially children.
Right. Well, because I guess accessibility has just gone through the roof, you know, in recent years as compared to where it was before. But are we also seeing trends in terms of we are more easily bored and anxious now than we used to be?
Yeah. I mean, the data would suggest, and this is sort of the story that we put together in the Distracted Mind, that all of those forces are taking place. And they're both on different sides of the equation. One is on the diminishing benefits we get of being in a source are not just that you're using up the information in that source, like a squirrel using up the nuts in the tree, but these very human factors of increasing anxiety and boredom. I mean, if you could experience that yourself, I mean, if you just try to do one thing, you know, which is one of the advice that I do give for a while, you could feel anxiety of like not doing something else or checking in on a post or just like, wow, I'm bored, accumulate pretty rapidly. And this has been well described, especially children feel these forces to a very high degree. And they become very noticeable when you remove their technology away from them. And so, you know, it's part of the reality of how we interact in the world now. And I think it forces us to lose a lot of the control that we want to have over our technology, such that it essentially is exerting control over us.
You know, that's interesting. And that idea of being able to stick with something for a long time, it's intrigued me for ages. And once again, in high school, I remember I was always impressed how we did marching band camp. And for 2 weeks, somehow, you know, 100 plus of us would endure, you know, the pretty hot summer Illinois days for 8+ hour stretches day after day after day. And I just thought, wow, it'd be so powerful if I could just do this myself, you know, whatever I wanted to, you know, learn or improve or accomplish, whether it's, you know, hunkering down to write a book or whatnot. And yet it was so difficult. I guess there's a whole nother element associated with accountability and looking like a slacker. If you say, no, guys, I'm out, which is a lot harder to do in a group setting than individually. But so how can we sort of work these levers in terms of engaging things so that we are more engaged and interested in what we're doing? We feel less anxious about what we might be missing out on, or we have, you know, less accessibility to pull us in another direction. So actionably, how can we pull these levers to do more great focusing?
Yeah. So, you know, that was the reason why I went to this path of using a foraging model in the first place, so that we have a framework now. We see the influences. On one side, accessibility drives us to another source that's easily obtainable. And on the other side, our boredom and anxiety cause us to want to leave the source that we're in. And so those are three levers right there that you could learn how to control. You know, accessibility is in some ways a little easier because it's less abstract. You could just sit down, quit your email program. If you're writing an article, quit, you know, Twitter, put your phone on airplane mode, close your door, work in a less distracting environment and really create the type of, you know, surroundings that foster a singular focus where it's just not accessibility. I know people that will put their phone in their bag when they drive home from work because if they have it in their lap, the accessibility will make them, you know, go to it even when they're at a light. You know, and so if you feel that accessibility is really pulling on you, which I think it is for many people. I mean, I feel it myself. I could be there writing an article, and if my email program is open, subconsciously I just go over to it and look. Not that I need to look, not that, you know, anything pinged me. Well, you know, I was working just fine, but because it was so easy, I just, you know, sort of reflexively took a look at it or, you know, an open Facebook page. And so I do quit those programs when I'm writing on something. So I think managing accessibility is a real, very tangible one that people could wrap their hands around. The other side of it, decreasing the anxiety that you feel of missing out on things or not, you know, not being productive because you think productivity is doing a lot of things at the same time, as well as boredom. You know, to me, the first step of those of dealing with that is to just put yourself in the situation where you decrease accessibility, do one thing, and actually feel those emotions, that anxiety, that stress, that boredom accumulate. And just wrap your head around what it is, become a little bit more introspective and realize that it's not going to kill you. It's fine to be bored. And it's fine to be a bit hungry and it's fine to be a bit anxious. And that these feelings are, they don't need to necessarily be corrected immediately. You can allow them to just sort of bake in a little bit and you might find that they go away after a while. I always sort of make the parallel between, you know, sitting down for an hour to do one thing, like going out and running a mile, let's say. You know, the first time you do it, it could be unbearable. You could be like, wow, I never want to run again. But over time, you actually get a pleasure and reward in doing that one thing. And all of the negative aspects that accumulate really rapidly when you're not used to it start going away. So I would say that, you know, there's other tricks and apps and ways that you could sort of, you know, have people not text you when you're doing something else. So that decreases the anxiety. And in the book, we talk about lots of fancy tricks of dealing with anxiety and boredom. But the one that, you know, the easier one to talk about that I think is a good start is to just put yourself in the scenario where you experience it and just learn how to manage it. Even waiting online at a supermarket, you know, I'm in Whole Foods and I have only 2 minutes to wait and I still feel the allure of pulling out my phone and, you know, checking something, you know, just leave it away. It's okay. Just feel a little boredom. Just maybe do some internal thinking or looking around. So that's, I think, a good starting point.
Certainly. And so, well, you mentioned tricks. I can't resist. Can we hear the tricks too?
Yeah. So, you know, there are basically ways of using technology to help as well. So one of the things that, you know, we recommend and others have as well is when dealing with the anxiety of missing out is to have people be aware, for example, when you're driving or when you're working so that you don't think that there's, you know, texts and other communications coming in when you know you should be focusing. People do similar tricks like that at work where they'll put up like a sign of, do not disturb, I'm focusing. Of that nature. The other trick that's less tech, but it's about breaks, and especially true for boredom, is instead of going an entire hour, try to go 10 minutes and take a minute break, and then go right back to 10 minutes and work through the hour in those segments. And this way, you know, that the boredom and even the anxiety could be relieved by that break. But the trick, and then each day you could make the, you know, now go 15 minutes, 20 minutes, learn how to do 20 minutes with just 2 breaks along the way. But one of the tricks of this approach is to not take like tech breaks, especially like social media or email, in those short breaks, because then they could just take you through these sinkholes where you just an hour later, you're like, wow, I just totally failed there. So the types of things that I think help, especially with anxiety and boredom, when you're taking those breaks, are like some meditation and mindfulness to get better at that type of internal focus, exposure to nature, even light physical exercise in your office or wherever you are. Those are the things that can help fill those breaks. And then you just bounce right back into your singular focus.
That's excellent. And I'm thinking here, just in my own experience, like if I'm on vacation, I feel so much better having the out of office email reply up and going than not going. Just because it's just sort of like, oh, that's handled. They know.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not expecting anything from me. And they even have other resources they can turn to get whatever they're asking about met.
Exactly. That's a perfect example of using technology to reduce that anxiety. And you know, that anxiety is really strong when you're on vacation. There was a time in the past where vacation meant that you were actually completely inaccessible and not actually working. And that's gone. You know, many people are still communicating with their work every single day, and they feel that anxiety that even a short period away is going to be, you know, incredibly destructive. But as you described, there's a way of structuring your time when you leave your work environment or study environment that is set up to give you success and actually disengaging from it.
Well, I'd also like to talk a little bit about the boredom lever here, because, you know, sometimes I've just marveled at how, you know, I could hunker down and play my favorite computer game from 1993, Master of Orion, for like 6 hours straight. But then, you know, I've got sort of an email inbox backlog, and I have never successfully been able to crank at it for 6 hours in one day. I think my max is like 3.5. The boredom, I guess, overwhelmed me. And so one tool you mentioned, just practice, you know, train it, you know, get better like you would in training for a marathon. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else we can do to somehow find excitement and engagement in the things that currently seem boring to us?
It could be really challenging. You know, I'm not going to claim that you could turn email into the most fun activity in the world. You know, video games are a hard thing to compete with. They are designed by very clever people to have reward cycles and multiple different time scales that really keep you engaged. I mean, they're doing exactly what email doesn't do frequently, which is, you know, mix it up and challenge you at a high level and give you, you know, constant feedback on how you're doing. And so, you know, this is, you know, one of the core challenges. It's really hard to compete with a lot of modern day media that is designed to appeal to people because of these rapid reward cycles. You could do things to try to gamify doing email and compete and things of that nature. But personally, I don't really feel like they work that well. I would, you know, how I've done it myself, it's always easy for me to describe what I do myself, is really just to learn and to retrain that ability to sustain attention and not be totally derailed every time you try to do it. And like anything else, like going to the gym, running, it takes practice. It doesn't necessarily come the first time. You have to work through it and just get better at it. And don't try to bite off too much and then just be completely disillusioned. The boredom goes away when you engage in something, and then you might find that, wow, I actually am liking doing this. And, you know, maybe it's not email, but certainly having a conversation with your significant other as opposed to interrupting it every 3 minutes to check your phone, or writing an article that you're really excited about, or reading a book that, you know, you do find engaging, you can get more enjoyment out of it if you just train yourself to sustain your focus for a longer period of time.
All right. Well, so we talk about training. You mentioned mindfulness and meditation. What would be sort of your top recommended practices in terms of I'm thinking about learning about some Buddhist practitioners who stared at a wall for months. You're like, wow, that's really impressive. And so are there particular mindfulness practices, or can we play some of your video games, or what are some of the other kind of activities we can engage in to strengthen our capacity here?
Yeah. So, you know, the basic practice of concentrated meditation doesn't require a lot of fancy tools. It's where you learn over time to focus usually on your breath. It could be words. It could be a visual image in your mind. Hold the focus. Be aware when your mind wanders, and without judgment, just bring it back and hold it again. You know, that's like one of the most ancient practices, and it appears in many, many different forms of meditation. And has a long history of success in helping with attention, but also stress and mood. And you know, so it's quite valuable, and it's, you know, essentially at its core, it's a attention training exercise. Some people have difficulty with it. They might be pushed to do too much and feel like they don't get it. They can't find their breath. We actually designed a video game. That's what we do. We take principles from other practices that have benefits in the real world, like meditation, like rhythm and music, physical fitness, and then we build algorithms that can allow you to baby step into it so that it's adaptive to how good you are at it. You're getting feedback on how you're doing, and you can extend and improve your performance gradually over time. And we did that with meditation. We have a game called MetaTrain. We're writing up our first paper on our results right now, showing that we have been able to improve sustained attention abilities in millennials and 20-year-olds engaging in this app for 6 weeks. So we're super excited about it. It's not publicly available yet. We're very conservative with how we release things into the market. We want to know that it actually does what we say it's going to do. But we've been working on this for many years now, and the data is quite convincing. So, you know, these are some of the things that you could do right now, and that'll be coming out soon.
Oh, that's great. Now, are any of your games available for the public to do now, and how can we get there, or are they all not yet there?
They're all not yet there. This is sort of one of the more frustrating points. The one that's closest is the ADHD treatment, which, you know, I hope arrives, you know, in 2019, maybe by the end of this year. We'll see. You know, the process is unclear because it's a new treatment, a new device. But that'll be the first to arrive. And that is clearly, as I described, the medical route. It'll be a prescribable treatment by doctors to children that have ADHD. The only thing right now that's the only thing that will be FDA approved that's not a pharmaceutical or drug. So very exciting. It doesn't mean that all of our technologies are going to go down that medical pathway. For example, the meditation training game, I'm now looking at other companies that build more consumer-facing meditation and mindfulness apps as partners. So that's happening now. So hopefully next year you'll start seeing things that we've been working on for a decade that start appearing in the world.
That's cool. And can we also touch on exercise for a bit? You know, there's many forms of exercise, yoga, high intensity intervals, steady state cardio, strength training. Are there any particular exercise interventions that seem to go farther in molding the brain to make it able to focus for longer periods?
Well, most of the data on how exercise improves attention and cognitive abilities more broadly focus on aerobic exercise. Sometimes high intensity interval training, sometimes just long endurance aerobic training. And the data is quite convincing, especially in aging and older adults, and even in children as well. So there's lots of great data and many meta-analysis that have, put together results from many different papers to reach that conclusion. But there's also data about strength training as well that's often frequently ignored. So I would say, both strength and aerobic training. I'm not as familiar with the literature on yoga, but, more and more researchers are exploring, you know, these practices, as I said, that have been around for a long time and are trying to put them in more randomized controlled trials. So, and I would even just add one thing that with older adults, even the act of just getting out and walking has been shown to be beneficial as well.
Oh, cool. Well, Adam, tell me, anything else you want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and hear about some of your favorite things?
I think that is it. You know, I guess I always like to sort of conclude this part of the discussion by saying that there's a lot of things you could do as far as like lifestyle changes that are shown to be good for your brand. And I put it into five pillars. So physical exercise, we just talked about that. Cognitive challenge, we've been talking about that, some of the things we're creating, but just the types of way of engaging in the world around you that push you out of your comfort zone. Travel, learning music, even, complex social interactions, which also has the benefit of reducing isolation and loneliness, which is also not good for your brain. And so physical challenge, cognitive challenge, nutrition, sleep management, and stress management. And by stress management, I don't mean the elimination of all stress. Our brains and our bodies actually like some stress. The challenge is what it responds to, pushes it, into a more dynamic phase. But it's that helpless chronic stress that really induces damage in the brain that should be avoided. So while you do those things in your daily lives, we're working on, technological implementations that aren't meant to replace them, but just act as tools to help optimize abilities that might not be potentially optimized otherwise.
Well, Adam, not to open up a whole rat's nest, but you said nutrition. Could you give us the 1 minute do's and don'ts on nutrition for the brain?
Sure. Nutrition is as complicated as it gets when it comes to research, because the types of randomized controlled trials that are easy, not necessarily easy, but very doable with pharmaceutical drugs, more challenging to do with video game treatments, but doable, we've shown that now, are even more difficult to do with nutrition. Those randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials are hard to pull off. And so there's not a lot of data. And, we constantly seem, as professionals, health professionals, change our recommendations, which I think that, a lot is due to this challenge that I just described. But the data, at least on the aging perspective of living long, not just long, but long well with a healthy brain, I would say the data is strongest for the Mediterranean diet. So nuts, legumes, fruits, vegetables, olive oil, even red wine finds itself on that list. And trying to maintain that more whole food diet, which I think probably a lot of your readers already locked into this type of advice. I would say that's where the strongest data lives.
I love great innovations like Adam's that brilliantly enhance an established industry. Another startup called Haven Life Insurance Agency is doing the same with term life insurance. Haven Life helps you apply for term life insurance coverage issued by MassMutual with remarkable speed and ease. Instead of dealing with a multi-week long process, yes, weeks really is typical. To get a decision on coverage, you can apply online with Haven Life anytime and get a coverage decision in minutes. You can get robust protection for surprisingly little. For example, a 35-year-old guy in excellent health could get a $500,000 20-year Haven Life term policy issued by MassMutual for around $21 a month. And solid coverage it is. Haven Life is backed and wholly owned by MassMutual, a leading insurer who's been around for over 160 years. To get your free quote, head over to welcome.havenlife.com/awesome. That's welcome.havenlife.com/awesome for your free quote today. All right. Well, now could you share with us a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
I have a quote that I actually came up with that some of my friends like to share back to me at certain times, especially when I might not be following it as much as I should. So I once said, all of life is a celebration of life. And I do think it's a good reminder because many times we're always sort of seeking this like peak experience that is like the culmination of what you've been working for. And you tend to sort of just drive right by all the little wins and all the little joys that happen. And, I experience that as well. But I do try to pull myself out of that pattern and really just celebrate it all of life. So that's one that I try to keep dear and close to my heart.
Mm-hmm. And from all your research, do you have a study that is a favorite or something that comes up again and again, either your own or from someone else?
Definitely our most cited paper is our Nature paper in 2013, where we showed that our video game improves cognitive control in older adults. I would say the other paper that I'm really proud of that that helped influence my career a lot, including The Distracted Mind, was a study, I guess, like 15 years ago now, showing that when older adults have senior moments, what they feel like are memory challenges, they're really attentional in nature. They're more attention-driven than memory per se, specifically. And even there, the attention is not that they're not focusing on what's relevant to them, but they're not ignoring or filtering the irrelevant information. That attending and ignoring are not just two sides of the same coin. If you focus more, you're not necessarily ignoring more. You could be focusing, and we found that six-year-olds focus like 20-year-olds, but where they fail is the filtering of irrelevant information. And when that gets in through the fortress gates, it creates interference with what they're trying to remember and creates this degradation that's experienced as these sort of memory losses. So I quite like that work. That study set off a whole series of studies showing more in more detail what was going on neurally when these suppression deficits occur.
Mm-hmm. And how about a favorite book?
I really was incredibly influenced by books that were written in the 50s by Isaac Asimov called The Foundation series, sort of, in my mind, the birth of science fiction. And I read a little bit of science fiction every day, pretty much around the year, because it pushes me to think about the future and outside of the box of what we're experiencing right now. And I feel like, I go back to The Foundation every several years, read it again, because it just sort of set the pace for how you look into the future in a way that's not just about technology, but really about humanity.
Mm-hmm. And how about a favorite tool, something you use that helps you be awesome at your job?
I have to say, I use tablets a lot. I think I use them more than most people do. I use them in the gym. I use them on flights. I find it like less burdensome a lot of times than laptops and more accessible than my phone. And that's something that I use for notes, for my calendar reminders. And yeah, I think that I probably engage in tablet use more than most people.
All right. And how about a favorite habit?
The habit that I've been doing since I've been 17 years old is going to the gym pretty much every day. I do a bit of aerobic exercise and a bit of weight training. I'm completely addicted to it. And when I don't do it, if I'm just traveling and can't, and I even do it on the road, I don't feel just the physical effects of it, but the entire like full stack, like from the concentration to my mood. And so I would say that habit, which, has its burden, I'm a little bit of a slave to it, has much more benefits. So I would say that would be the one.
Mm-hmm. And Adam, if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
Oh, well, that's a fun one for me to answer, because I have lots of entities, as we talked about. But around just a couple of days ago, I finished putting together with my wife's assistant. She's an amazing web programmer. A website, Ghazali.com. So just my last name.com. And there I sort of aggregate all the different things in my life, from nature photography, and winemaking, to all the things that we already talked about. So that's my new home base online.
Oh, cool. And do you have a final challenge or call to action you'd issue to folks seeking to be awesome at their jobs?
I think that the challenge is really to get to know yourself better. It sounds trite maybe, but it's a process, and it doesn't come for free. It takes time and patience and honesty. But it goes a long way. It's not the full distance that you could go with just insight. You do have to have a plan and a strategy and work to break habits. But it is something that I have found really valuable to get in the practice of understanding how your brain is working and why you do certain things.
Perfect. Well, Adam, this has been such a treat. Thank you so much for taking this time and the great stuff you're doing in the world. I'm looking forward to playing your games when they're available, and just wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you so much. It was nice talking with you.
I really appreciate Adam's simple take that it's fine to be bored. It's fine to be hungry. It's fine to be anxious. And these sensations don't need to be immediately addressed. You can experience them for a bit, and in so doing, you may finally go away and you increase your capacity to deal with them. And then such huge, great things become unlocked for your focus abilities. So hope you dug that and more. If you want to check out the show notes, the transcript, the links to items we've referenced, it's at awesomeatyourjob.com/ep324. If you haven't already, I hope you'll push subscribe. We'll hear from our next guest. It's Lauren Zander. She's chatting about how to have difficult conversations with yourself and with others. Hope to catch you there. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. To get the most out of this conversation, visit awesomeatyourjob.com to find today's show notes, transcript, and infographic summary cheat sheet. For more entertaining professional skill sharpening, be sure to subscribe to catch the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.